Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim for the next Economist Mom segment. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. Policymakers are considering setting new discretionary spending levels for just the next fiscal year, as opposed to recent deals in 2013, 2015, and 2017 that took a two-year approach. They hope to do what they did in years past, avoid strict caps and the onset of across-the-board cuts known as sequestration. Fiscal year 2020 begins October 1st. Without an agreement, discretionary spending would see roughly a 10% reduction, or about $125 billion less than this year's levels. There is hope that focusing on just one year will simplify negotiations, which have stalled. But that could lead to another spending level shutdown next year, on the eve of the presidential election. Both formal and informal talks between leadership to date have made little gains. Amidst budget negotiations, the House is holding Trump administration officials in contempt of Congress, and leadership is faulting the administration for the current impasse in the appropriations process. Helping smooth relations and the budget process will be the new White House legislative liaison. More than $66 million has been diverted from other projects by the Air Force to help pay for the cleanup of sites made toxic from past use of firefighting foam containing PFAS, which health experts say can increase the risk of a number of illnesses, including certain cancers. The Pentagon told lawmakers the cost of cleanup could be as much as $2 billion and result in diverting additional otherwise dedicated funds. The rising cost of entitlement or mandatory spending programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid have long been identified as a key driver of rising budget deficits. According to a Congressional Budget Office report, some of those programs grow more quickly than others. Means-tested programs like Medicaid and food stamps are not projected to grow as quickly as broader-based programs like Social Security and Medicare. While means-tested programs are projected to grow at an average annual rate of 4% in the coming decade, spending on other mandatory programs is forecast to grow at nearly 6%, according to CBO. One caveat is Medicaid, which is means-tested, but still projected to grow by 5.5% a year from fiscal years 2020 through 2029, up from 4.9% over the last decade. Up next, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim will join me to continue our discussion on the evolving economy. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim for our Economist Mom segment. Diane is a principal at the District Economics Group. She and Bob are regular contributors on the show. Welcome back.
Thanks, Chase. It's great to be back here.
So I'd like to pick up on our previous shows, the discussion we've been having about how the economy has changed, how government systems and the workforce can adapt to it. Last time we discussed how demographics have shifted and how some systems like Medicare and Social Security might need to be reformed in order to adapt to the new economy. Today, we'll break up our conversation into two segments. And in this first portion of our discussion, I want to get into something we've been alluding to, and that is how the nature of work has changed, including the current state of the traditional employer-employee relationship and how it's impacted by changes in the economy. And then we'll jump into how benefit systems tied to traditional employment relationships aren't well suited for these changes in the economy, as well as some possible solutions. So to kick off the first part of our discussion, I thought it would be good for you, Diane, to explain how the nature of work is changing and what the workforce, aside from demographics, is starting to look like.
You know, I think that over the past decade, really, we've seen an acceleration in this notion of the so-called gig economy, which is a term that used to apply to, like, you know, musicians that were playing for one night, you know, at a bar or something, a gig job. But it has broadened to this notion that it's kind of temporary and part-time and almost like piecework, like you're paying for a particular type of performance or work at a particular point in time, and it's a one-off. You know, it's not a recurring a recurring type of job. It's broadened even actually beyond that, because now gig workers are often, that label's often applied to simply people that have employers or think they have employers work to provide services through a company, but they're not the traditional employee of the company. They're rather a contractor, even if they don't consider themselves deserving of that label or appropriate for that label. They're essentially independent contractors in terms of how federal law perceives them, labor laws and also tax law and government benefit program law. So I think there's just more and more work that happens in the economy that is not delivered through the traditional employer-employee relationship. And therefore, a lot of this work, I maintain, is not really seen and measured by economists and by government statisticians, because it's, we're used to measuring things on official, like, forms, tax forms, you know, and employer forms, and employers and employees are used to answering surveys such as the Bureau of Labor Statistics monthly employment surveys. They're used to answering those questions about traditional work, and so work that has kind of blurred the lines between work and just life, people have a hard time characterizing it, and businesses are not really required to report that kind of work the way they're required to report the work hours of traditional employees.
Diane, can you maybe share some insight as to what type of industries are seeing this sort of change? Is it a permanent evolution, or is this something where the economy is just resetting towards different industries and the workforce needs to adapt to it? Or is this almost a generational change in the perspective of how one works and how long they work for a particular company and how they're paid?
Mm-hmm. Technological progress has had a lot to do with how the nature of work has changed. Going back, you know, I'm going to get to the iPhone, the app economy, but first, let's talk about automation, you know, and how automation and capacity for manufacturers to offshore manufacturing work to other countries. Both of those had a significant effect on the manufacturing sector in terms of fewer jobs in manufacturing being located in the U.S., either because a lot of those jobs were very mechanically routine, repetitive tasks that could be accomplished either by robots and machines, or they could be accomplished remotely in other countries. I think it started with that shift in manufacturing that caused that's permanent decline, because it's not just because we had a lull in our demand for manufactured goods. It's because we changed the way we produce those manufactured goods. And then the advent of the digital economy really created this entire new sets of industries that sometimes have displaced more traditional industries and occupations. So the best example of a platform, an online platform workforce, is the ride-sharing, the Uber and Lyft companies, and how that has replaced, but not completely displaced, the more traditional taxi cab industry. So, you know, I think that while technological advances have changed the mix of industry outputs and employment, they haven't reduced it necessarily. They've, you know, our employment levels are still growing, and that's because people are moving out of certain old school type industries where we made things to the newer industries where we're providing services that, by the way, a lot of these services, it's impossible to completely offshore or automate them. But now Uber and Lyft drivers are just worrying about the advent of driverless cars, which will even automate away Uber and Lyft driver jobs. So, but there are a lot of services that are now delivered through apps. So you can hire a dog walker, you can hire a handyman, you can rent out your vacation home. There's a lot of the economy that takes place over these apps, these mobile platforms. And that has also been a challenge for economists, for government economists, because we just have a harder time seeing that economy because it's not treated by our government programs the same way as the traditional employment economy is.
And when economists look at projecting future growth of the nation's economy, are there any adjustments that can be made in terms of those calculations to pull in that almost unseen economy that's developing?
Well, you know, I always kind of laugh at how we economists always are trying to predict the future using data from the past. Because it's just how we're trained to do empirical analysis. It's like, okay, let's find a data set that's covering past years of data. Let's look for patterns in those past years of data, and then let's apply them to the future, like, you know, how the relationships between these variables in the past, like employment by industry or wages, how they related to the economic conditions of the time or the demographics even of the time. And then let's project what we know will be changes in the demographic makeup of our country and apply them to the parameters that come out of the past data to predict the future. And, you know, the trouble is that, you know, I don't know how many years ago we didn't have the iPhone, right? I mean, like 10 to 15 years ago, the iPhone didn't even exist, I think. You know, these new industries have just recently come up. They were born with the invention of the App Store on the iPhone. And so, you know, it would have been impossible to predict 20 years ago that the taxi service would transform into this industry where any old person could actually provide that service in their spare time using their own car. You know, like, we would have never predicted that. And similarly, it's very hard for economists now to predict what driverless cars are going to do to employment in the future, because it doesn't just affect employment among drivers. It affects things like industry mix. So there are all these factors that will change with the advent of and adoption of driverless vehicles. And there's so many question marks right now about how fast that will happen, because the technology is progressing faster than our willingness to, like, trust a robot to get us around safely. So I think that, you know, for example, we do studies on the effect of automation on different types of occupation, but that's based on old mixes of skills that are characterized as part of occupations according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics based on past definitions of occupations. And so, you know, I think there's just a limit to how much we can predict the future, given that the future's not here yet.
I'm not an economic forecaster. Let me make that perfectly clear. But it seems to me that if I were an economic forecaster, there's a political dilemma in this, is that it's easier to quantify the jobs that could be at risk or go away than the jobs that might be created by a technology you don't even know is there.
We can't imagine those jobs, right.
Yeah. I mean, to use the classic example of the buggy whip industry or something before the automobile came along, you could see the jobs that would go away, but you wouldn't necessarily know that people would be employed at Henry Ford.
Repairing automobiles and making automobiles, so, right.
And this is true now. I mean, you know, Diane mentioned certain professions that few years ago we wouldn't have even imagined, and the workforce has changed so much since I started, you know, and people, you know, we used to have, like, travel agents. I guess there still are travel agents, but even bank tellers, I mean...
Right, there are banks you walk into now and there's no teller window.
Yeah.
And you go in and there are people there to help you, but not to, like, you don't walk up to the window. They're there and they have a cafe in there and you can read books in there while they try to sell you different investment
different products or something. Yeah,
yeah, so the nature, the interaction that takes place just in retail services where there used to be a certain type of face-to-face interaction between customer and salesperson or employee, customer service person, has changed a lot.
Yeah, now my uncle didn't get it. He was in his 90s, and he would go into the bank where he went for years to cash a check.
Right.
And the teller would tell, there was somebody that was there, they'd tell him, Mr. Bixby, you can go out, you know, to use the ATM machine. And he said, I'm trying to save your job. So you'll have something to do.
Well, even on that, like you can deposit
yes.
checks via your phone now. You can take it. You have an app for most large banks where you can take a photo of the front and back of the check and submit it for deposit in your own account.
That's right. The only hassle these days in banking is when you actually need cash. It's like, yeah. Oh man, it doesn't come out of your iPhone. So you can only do all your transactions via, you know, like through your iPhone if you don't need real cash.
I think
right?
this
but
all
you can do anything.
I think this all leads to a really interesting discussion on monetary policy, which we won't get into today. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm talking to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim. We're talking about how the nature of the workforce has changed and how it can adapt to a changing economy. I actually wanted to go back to something you had said, Diane. You were talking about how there's been this almost permanent change in the economy, especially with the loss of many manufacturing jobs. And the question sort of in the back of my mind, and maybe it's because of the nature of politics right now and where we're heading as a nation, is there a way to actually roll back the clock and try and rejuvenate some of those industries and have reinvestment in them?
Well, I think just because in general we've lost a lot of old manufacturing jobs, like automobile manufacturing or durable goods manufacturing, we've lost a lot of that to other countries that have much cheaper labor. It doesn't mean that all is lost in terms of any type of manufacturing jobs. So, for example, the food manufacturing sector has done really well because food manufacturing is one area where the U.S. actually has a strong comparative advantage because we grow a lot of the food right here. You know, it's proximity to agriculture and it's also proximity to the customers because, you know, the food consumption is doing really well in this country. Like, it is a growing sector, especially through restaurants.
I eat a lot of food.
And, yeah. No, the eating out, you know, it was just a couple years ago that in the retail sales data, eating away from home surpassed eating food at home. And that's a recent signal of how the economy and our society is changing, is that younger people are more used to doing things on a more experiential level and convenience-wise. They like to go out. They go out way more than the baby boomers went out at their age. They spend a lot more money on experiences like vacations, you know, travel and eating out, and less money on things like a big fancy car or even a house. You know, they have less desire to purchase things and more desire to purchase experiences. So those industries are doing really well, and manufacturing actually feeds those industries because those industries use things too. They need input to provide those services. The other industry that is growing rapidly and is not going to go away is the healthcare sector. And there is a lot of manufacturing that supports the healthcare sector. And there are a lot of human workers that are still essential as workers in that sector, American workers, because those kinds of jobs either can't be automated away. Some of it can. Robots can do some of the heavy lifting in, like, nursing jobs, for example. But they can't be offshored because a lot of those healthcare professions, it's not just reading an x-ray, which could be done in India. It's actually delivering care at a personal level, hands-on care, to patients in person. And so because of that, you know, the occupations in highest demand, like the hottest professions, maybe other than data scientists, which could be offshore, are the nursing and sort of assisted the health aides, you know, the physical therapists, the occupational therapists, people who have to work with people in person. And just because demand for healthcare, of course, is rising because of the aging of our society, and because people are living longer and in need of assistance, of not just the healthcare variety, but personal assistance, like the assisted living, you know, homes, are not considered traditional healthcare facilities. And so they're also not covered by health insurance, by the way. So, you know, I think that those jobs are, there's always going to be huge demand for people in those professions. And so you are starting to see, I happen to know of actual cases of young men who, instead of going into manufacturing professions or, you know, sort of bend metal, heavy lifting kind of professions, they're going into nursing and the health, you know, these professions, and they're in the assisted living home. My dad's assisted living home has many young men that are working with patients, with clients, as they call them there. So I think that when the economy changes like this, with drastic changes in the mix of what we do, what we produce in terms of goods and services in the economy, the way the country adapts, the way our workforce adapts, is they switch to different professions. Now, it's hard to tell a middle-aged factory worker in an auto plant that if he gets laid off from GM, he just has to walk across the street to the hospital and apply for the medical technologist job or something, or a health aide job. But it's easy to tell young people who are in college to choose their majors wisely so that they can be prepared to take on, to be qualified for some of these jobs where there is very healthy demand now and in the future.
There is a role for the government to hear as we think about the direction of government spending programs, because the workforce is changing so much and people are going to change careers quite dramatically probably throughout their careers. There's a need for constant retraining, lifelong learning. And our government programs that assist with that need to be sensitive to that, and we probably need to be rethinking the federal government's approach to education and re-education and workforce training.
And before we jump into that topic, I want to save that for the next segment when we're talking a little bit more about solutions and the role of government in this changing economy. I want to stick with one more question related to the current state of things and where the workforce is trending, and that is, how has consumer behavior changed as it pertains to traditional benefits like health care, retirement, or even family leave?
The trouble with the gig economy and with young workers having a hard time or choosing not to take on a traditional employment role is that often it means that these young people, my children included, start out, not all my children, some of my children have traditional employment roles, but a lot of young people are starting out their careers in these non-traditional employment relationships, which means they're not starting with right off the bat, they don't have a retirement savings program offered to them through their work. Right off the bat, they're still on, you know, my health insurance policy. They don't have their own through work. And the reason why that's a problem is because we know that saving, you know, in terms of retirement saving goals, the sooner you start, the better. And so young people, because they're not in these traditional worker workplace roles, with a lot of benefits in their 20s, they're actually, it causes them to delay a lot of things. So there's a lot of talk about how, oh, well, the millennials, they're not getting married, they're not having babies. Are they just slower to do this, or is this a permanent difference with the millennials? And again, we can't predict this. We don't really know without maybe interviewing some millennials about, do you ever intend to grow up anyway? So so adulting, you know, adulting is a term that we apply to when millennials do eventually do things that seem like grown-up things, like buy a house, get married, you know, have children. And all of that is just at least being delayed, and we don't know, you know, there was recently data that was released showing that fertility has declined. We don't know if this is just a delay or a permanent, you know, level shift downward of that fertility rate, and that will, I just think young people are different these days, and they're having a hard time because the millennials, frankly, they came of age during the Great Recession. Like, they were just going into college or coming out of college as the Great Recession was still having a huge impact on their job prospects. So they sort of had a bad start, and then they have these employment relationships that aren't helping to get them caught up to where their parents might have been at the same age.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to economist Diane Lim and Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby in our Economist Mom segment. We've been discussing how the economy has changed and evolved, as well as how the nature of work has changed and how different systems can adapt to it. We'll actually pick up on our conversation after the break. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and economist Diane Lim for our Economist Mom segment. Diane is a principal at the District Economics Group. She and Bob are regular contributors on the show, and we're picking up where we left off in our last segment. We've been talking about how the economy has been changing, how the nature of work is changing. And one question, Diane, I didn't get to ask in our last segment that I think I'll kick off this segment with, and that is, how has collecting revenue for the government changed? I know there's the traditional W-2, there's 1099 for subcontractors and independent contractors. What does all that mean, and how is it impacting this economy?
Yeah, well, a lot of the kind of gig work that I talked about earlier, where people are working these temporary or part-time jobs and they're paid for kind of piecework rather than for set hours of work per week, those forms of work and those, the wages that are earned, or the, I should say, the income that is earned, not, is not considered wage, traditional wage income. And so if you are an Uber or Lyft driver, or if you are, well, I'll give my own example. I'm a part-time yoga teacher. And when I teach yoga, my yoga income, which is not very big, is reported to me from my yoga studio on a 1099 form, okay? A lot of my children have done jobs where at the end of the year, they don't get a W-2 because it's not like an hourly scheduled job. It's they work just occasionally a few hours here, a few hours there for a company, and they're paid to help out with an event, for example. And it's not an hourly pay. It's a set sort of fee that they report on a 1099 form. Okay, well, I will tell you that most of my kids, and I suspect they are a pretty representative sample of younger people, and I suspect that this is probably true for older people as well, they did not know that they were not a traditional employee until they got their 1099 form and asked me, you know, what the heck is this 1099 form? What does this mean? And so I think that one challenge that economists who study the labor market have had recently is trying to understand this part of the economy that works in the contractor, the independent contractor space, but doesn't even know they work in that space. And if you ask them, what do you do for a living? And do you have an employer, and do you earn wages from, you know, how many employers do you have that pay you wages and salary? They will not know how to answer that question, especially, it turns out, if you ask them only once a year at a certain time in the year that is not very close to the date that you got your 1099 form. It turns out that workers will forget that they worked, that they did a gig, you know, for they performed music, you know, in June, one weekend, and they got paid for it. They won't remember that when they're only asked about it, you know, months later.
Because whoever paid them has to fill out a 1099.
Right.
And that's how the government knows to send them it.
Well, okay, that there is that sort of two-party reporting system that the employer has an incentive to report that independent contractor income. The reason the employer wants to report that is it's a deduction. It's a cost for the company. The company has an incentive to issue those 1099 forms, But the employee, the worker, when they get the 1099 form, they don't really realize that this whole time they haven't been earning traditional wages and contributing taxes. Taxes are not withheld from a 1099 form. So income taxes are not withheld, and Social Security taxes are not withheld, meaning that a 1099 worker isn't really participating in the Social Security system. So that's part of what I meant by saying young people are not getting a start in our traditional systems that would provide them some financial security going forward.
One of the things that that all raises to me, or a question that it raises to me, is the economy actually being undercounted? If there's a lot of activity going on that's just not being recorded or in the usual traditional sense, but does that also mean that the retirement security platform in this country is actually less secure than it might appear to be?
You know, we actually don't know very much about the distribution of people who hold multiple jobs and what mix of wage and salary, traditional employment, and non-traditional sort of independent contractor work they have. Because, for example, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, when they do their contingent and alternative work survey, which they only have had budget to do once every several years, the last one they did was just in 2017, and the question they ask is whether people's primary line of work was in a contingent or alternative work arrangement, meaning which encompasses independent contractor status. And, you know, the numbers that came out of that survey, everyone was surprised because it's like, oh, we thought the gig economy was so big, but it turns out hardly anyone is a gig worker. Well, hardly anyone, it turns out, has that as a primary job, because it's usually a thing on the side. You know, it's a little extra income. And some people don't even consider it a job. Some people get this gig income just because it's a hobby for them, not because their primary motive is for money.
Like yoga teachers.
Like yoga teachers, exactly. You know, I think that we have a hard time measuring the gig economy. We also, if you think about the way the BLS measures the employment sector, they have two surveys. One is to ask households and ask individuals in households, were you employed? Were you unemployed? Are you in the labor force because you were looking for work even though you didn't have a job? So they use that to measure the employment rate, the labor force participation rate, the unemployment rate, different measures of underemployment. That's the household survey. On the employer side, they have something called the establishment survey, where they go to businesses and say, tell me how many people work for you. Okay? Now, there is not a one-to-one correspondence between me answering the household survey and saying, yes, I'm employed full-time. And BLS is all my employers responding that, yes, she counts as one job here. Because under the BLS measure, I have like four different employers because I teach as an adjunct part-time, and that is wage and salary income. I teach as a yoga teacher, that's independent contractor income. And I have a main full-time job. And those are all counted in the BLS establishment survey as a job. So that I'm counted, those jobs that I have that are just little jobs are counted as one full job in all these places. Because the establishment survey doesn't say how many hours a week is that job, like just give us full-time equivalents. No, they just say how many people do you employ? So we have bad measures, like we can't even reconcile the establishment survey with the household survey in terms of figuring out who holds which job.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You're listening to me. Bob Bixby and Diane Lim discuss the changing economy as well as the changing nature of work. And I think the point you just hit on there, Diane, about the difficulty of really reconciliation with how this dynamic has changed rolls nicely into the topic I really wanted to focus on this segment. And that is a discussion on how benefit systems that are tied to traditional employment relationships, whether they're well-suited for this type of economy. And then I think we can start talking about some solutions.
You know, if you think about our major government benefit systems, Social Security and Medicare, and how they are administered in terms of, you know, it's handled, taxes are collected through the employment, the traditional employment wage and salary relationship, and those And those traditional employment relationships are counted in terms of your work history that determines your level of benefits that you qualify for in retirement. If you consider that, you know, in order to participate in the Social Security system, you have to have a traditional wage and salary job with a traditional employer. And when you consider also that the benefits that employers themselves provide privately, their companies provide, like any extra perks, you know, if they contribute to a retirement savings account for you as an employee, often there's a vesting period that you have to work for so many years before, if you separated from the employee, you could take the employer provided portion of the retirement savings. There are huge hurdles to leaving and separating from an employer who is providing you this link to these important government benefit programs and also providing some of their own extra benefits to you that are conditional on your loyalty to them. So it's not a great feature of the labor market from my perspective in terms of it causes the labor market to be less agile than it really wants to be to respond to economic signals of what's the hot new occupation to be in or which company do I most align with in terms of their mission. It prevents workers from going to their highest valued use, and it also keeps workers in place for a long time. If they've been in a company for many years, it is very financially painful to leave that employer, and it's easy to stay, and especially with older workers who might have actually gotten in when there were more traditional pension policies in place. So I think that, you know, one problem with the current benefit system is it was designed at a time when this was the goal of most young workers, was to go work for one traditional employer and to work for them their entire career. It was fine to tie all the government benefit systems to that relationship. It was fine for the employer to give very generous pension benefits because they would benefit from, you know, decades of service that these workers would provide. But it was when the economy started to change in terms of people move employers and people don't have traditional work relationships, that means that fewer workers these days are participating in the government benefit programs, and more workers are wanting to move around and switch jobs more often in their career, but they're penalized for doing so or they're hampered from doing so.
So it doesn't sound like you think the current system does a very good job of delivering benefits, at least for up-and-coming generations, especially because of those generations' focus on being a little more agile within the labor market. So let's talk about some of the solutions. What kind of changes can be made in the structure of those benefit systems to create that agility?
Well, this is where I'm going to say I don't know if any of these solutions could actually happen because, you know, what I would really like to see is it's sort of hard to get there from here, given that we have the structure as it is that was established generations ago, and people are used to that and are counting on that structure of the system. You know, there are policymakers that are aware that the independent contractor economy is not getting access to the traditional government benefit programs and employer-provided benefits, and there are, you know, legislative efforts to try to provide the ability to participate in government benefit programs even if you don't have the traditional employer-employee relationship. So that's one. That's probably one of the easiest things to try to do with policy. A harder thing and a more fundamental thing is to stop sort of using the employment relationship as the primary delivery system or the primary connection between government programs and people, and come up with a way of taking it outside of the employment relationship, but delivering benefits based on the individual's experience rather than the company's size experience. I don't know. It's not. I'm a little bit at a loss as to, okay, how would you do that given that this current system is tied to the employer? I'm not really sure because our Social Security system is so ingrained and so enmeshed in our economy right now that I think the only way to change it is to expand the coverage, but you can't really break the current link. I doubt we would ever break the current link with a traditional employer. So I think the way forward is to expand coverage to the non-traditional worker.
Diane, can you break that down a little bit for me? What do you mean by breaking the link in that traditional employee-employer relationship? Do you mean you don't see us really moving to a truly universal healthcare system or
benefit? I mean, if we did want like universal healthcare, right, or a universal retirement, like public retirement security program, we would have to pull it out of how taxes are now collected on a W-2. Because the 1099, for example, the independent contractor, when the company pays an independent contractor, they don't pay anything into the Social Security system. They're not reporting what they pay the contractor as Social Security wages. So whatever they work is not counted as work hours toward the Social Security system.
People who are self-employed are supposed to pay the self-employment tax as if it was Social Security tax that an employer would withhold. They just pay the whole thing themselves, and they're supposed to fill that out. And that's how they're connected to the Social Security system. But I think a lot of people don't realize that they're supposed to pay that tax.
There's a lot of things that are in the tax system that are really conditioned on the traditional employer-employee relationship and one that lasts through the entire year.
And the more the workforce changes, the current system we have becomes more inefficient.
I want to go full circle here, and Bob, this goes back to something you were saying toward the end of the previous segment, and use this as sort of a wrap-up because we only have a little bit of time left here. And what would the two of you encourage policymakers to look at or examine? What changes would you hope to see, whether it's related to the tax system or health care or retirement benefits or even how we're collecting revenue for many of those systems or issuing benefits?
Well, I would hope that policymakers would take a look at how our economy and society has been changing over the years in terms of the nature of work has changed, and making benefits and tax systems that are responding to those changes in the nature of work in terms of benefits going with a person and not so much tied to the person staying in their employer-employee relationship. And with the tax system, there's really so much in our tax system that is tied to the family or the household as the unit of analysis, as a taxable unit, rather than individuals. So that leads to things like marriage penalties and marriage bonuses and unequal treatment of families of different sizes. And, you know, it would be so nice if the system were more, the tax system and the benefit systems were more geared toward keeping track of individuals rather than employment relationships and family relationships that change over time. It just creates an unequal playing field. There's an unequal distribution of benefits, and it also just kind of hamstrings the economy in terms of keeping people from moving to their highest valued uses, and it often makes it difficult for people to be mobile, either across family status or across jobs.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the political challenges are immense, and that's the problem. Is that in any sort of transition, you're going from, you know, what you had, what people are used to, and anytime you're changing that, it's easily demagogued politically. And the downside of that is you may be losing an entire generation of people who just find that politicians aren't speaking to them,
right?
Because they're talking about
old systems,
right?
Old
exactly,
ways,
yeah.
Old ways of doing
old
things.
Old systems, and I think a lot of what you're finding of younger people who tune out politically is that they don't hear politicians addressing them and their generation and how the workforce is changing. If you want to have a conversation based on what you just asked, Chase, you know, how would you change this? You wouldn't get much creative thinking. It's very easy to scare people by saying that it's going to destroy retirement or health care benefits for people already invested in that system. So the transition is very difficult. Whatever you do, it really needs to be phased in. But having portability is really the key.
Yeah, that's the word that I couldn't think of. Yes, portability.
And I think I would just chime in there and add not only portability for a lot of those systems and benefits, but also more of a long-term thinking with regard to education and that system as well, leading into the labor force. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Diane Lim during the Economist Mom segment. We wrapped up our conversation on the nation's changing economy and the changing nature of work. Thank you for joining the show once again, Diane and Bob.
Thank you, Chase.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.